reconquering of Spain, as the Christian armies called it, took a very long time. It was a very slow process leading up to 1492, when the Iberian Peninsula was taken fully by Christian armies and Muslims and Jews were expelled. So there were Jews living in the Christian areas of Spain before then. So it's possible that Ladino arose before then as well. But Ladino is a combination of Hebrew and Spanish, which is still spoken in various places throughout the world. Of course, Yiddish is probably the language we're most familiar with that falls into this category. And Yiddish is its own civilization, as well as its own language. Can anyone give me the etymological definition of Yiddish?
Oh. Yid for Jew.
Deutsch.
Jewish German. That's what it means. Yehudish. Yehudi Deutsch. Exactly. Yiddish is Jewish German. And some Germans can understand Yiddish. But it's a different language. It's a different dialect. Okay. Let me give you some other examples. See how many you got already of mine. I've become a little bit interested in this, so I found some examples that are actually not very commonly known, but I think you'll find them interesting as well. Here's one that I came across. I didn't know it existed until I came across it in the Encyclopedia of Islam. Judeo-Berber. Can anyone explain that?
Morocco.
Exactly. It's from Morocco. The Berbers were the native people of North Africa prior to the Arab conquests. They still lived there later on, of course, but that was the general term given to them.
Would that also include, like, Algeria?
Yeah, Tunisia, Algeria, right? As well. Yeah, Tunisia, yes. So, the name that was given, maybe by the Arabs, maybe by the Mediterranean peoples to the North Africans, was Berber. It's the same as Greek barbar, in other words, barbarian. In other words, they speak a different language than we do. They say bar, 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 bar. We don't understand what they're saying. They speak a different language, so they're barbarians. Well,
in the days of pirates, on Barbary Coast.
Is it?
1800s, 1700s.
Yeah. So, in ancient times, there were Jews living among the Berbers in North Africa, and they developed a hybrid language between Hebrew and Berber, which is called Judeo-Berber. There's also a language called Judeo-Persian. Which is Farsi written in Hebrew letters, mm-hmm. with the introduction of Hebrew vocabulary and so forth, just like Yiddish is German written in Hebrew letters with the introduction of Hebrew vocabulary and modification of meaning.
I mean,
why Amharic or something, I don't know anything about Amharic, but I've heard that it's a Semitic language.
We have someone here.
I don't know.
Why do you see this where you have the Jews are going that they're taking the language and writing in Hebrew? I mean, you don't really see that in any other language, any other culture, where that instead of just learning that language,
to make their own.
Yeah.
I mean, we got too much Yiddish in English anyway, but.
That's a good question. I'm going to let Bobby answer that
one. Okay.
Because Jews are smart enough to do it.
Okay. Directly to the movie Selig.
Okay.
No, well, he was a cultural chameleon.
Oh, that's right.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Jews will assimilate only so far into a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere they've ever lived, they've had a big influence on the culture, mm-hmm. as far as with education and with history and with those such of things. So I think it's multifaceted, but clearly because they were bringing something new into what they already had, which was their writings.
So why has there never been a Judeo-English?
There is. I said we have a lot of English.
Well, Yinglish. Have you ever heard of Yinglish?
Yeah, exactly.
Some people do speak Judeo-English.
Well, Well, you're going to take an eye out with that.
But actually,
Aethmir, what do you want?
But actually, that's a good question. It's if you're in love with this expression, it's the exception that proves the rule in a sense, because something new happened in America that had never happened before in the history of the Jews, which was their ability to assimilate completely into society, which had never happened in any other country previously.
That's true.
What's Judeo-tat? I wasn't paying attention.
Okay, this is my last example, Judeo-tat. Tat is a Persian, well, it can refer, I think, to different languages, but in this case, Judeo-tat refers to the language of the mountain Jews in the Caucasus Mountains in southern Russia, where Chechnya is, in between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. And it's a combination of Hebrew with Persian and Turkic elements of language. And I'm sure there are others that could be added to this list as well. But we're running out of time.
How much of this transliteration?
You mean in these languages?
Uh-huh.
I think it would vary depending on which language.
You know, transliterating the other language into Hebrew letters.
Yeah, I think it would vary depending on the language. I mean, the standard figure that I've heard for Yiddish, for example, is that it's 70% German. So that's a pretty high degree of German. But of course, those German words receive slightly different meanings in the language as it develops.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They're imbued with Jewish meaning as well.
Well, when we have song lyrics up, we have the transliterations of song lyrics up on Saturday mornings.
Now you're going to think about it more carefully,
yeah,
aren't you?
We're doing something similar, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that's a form of Judeo-English, in a sense, because it's a hybrid between Hebrew and English letters. It's not really a separate language, per se. No one's speaking in it, no one's writing in it. It's not developing its own concepts and so forth, but it's sort of like how these languages could have first developed.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the misspelled pieces of it that are up there? Son of David English.
That's how these languages distinguish themselves. Errors creep in, they distort things, and so all of a sudden they're a new language. Did they have transparencies back to that? Okay, so I think, for me at least, this broad context helps greatly to explain the concept of Jewish Greek and why it arose and what it is. Because you can see it's not a unique thing. It fits into a universal pattern of Jewish history that is repeated over and over again in many different parts of the world, in many different societies, with many different languages. That said, we are going to deal with Jewish Greek, at least a little bit. And what I was planning to do is to give you a few demonstrations of how it exists. We've already done a couple of them that I had planned, in fact. One of them was to look at the Greek lexicon, and fortunately I opened up to a page that illustrated my point. But I think that shows you how easy it would be to prove the point just by looking at a Greek lexicon. A second one that we already considered was the notion of Christos. And a third one that I wanted to mention, because it's in the book, has to do with my friend Argyrios, with whom I discussed these matters when I was first exploring them and my father was first interested in them. Does anyone remember what Argyrios said? And actually, before class today, I was looking through things I had written, emails and so forth from that time period, and I actually found his original email, which is almost quoted in this book. It's very interesting. Does anyone remember what Argyrios said about this whole question? I mean, after all, he's Greek. He should know what's going on. Isn't the New Testament written in Greek? If you have a question, ask him.
Is this on page 20? 22.
He said it was something that was...
Yes, it starts on page 20.
But it's pretending to be Greek, but it's not really Greek.
Right. He said it would be much easier to understand the New Testament if it were written in Greek, as opposed to something that pretends to be Greek but isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then he explained that a little bit. Do you remember the explanation? Or what was his experience in school?
Oh.
He used a terminology that his teacher marked as wrong. The teacher said basically it's not Greek, it's Jewish Greek.
Right, he used a terminology that was wrong. And I looked at the email, and he was describing this as a common thing with him and other, his fellow students, that they would use some sort of phrase or terminology that was in the New Testament, and the teacher would mark it as wrong, and they would say, but it's in the New Testament, it's in the Bible. How can you mark it wrong? And the teacher would say, the New Testament is not written in Greek. The New Testament is written in Jewish Greek. That's wrong. And then in the further explanation of this, you may remember that, as Argyrios was saying, Greek theologians and people associated with that strain will always say that the New Testament is written in Greek because they wanted the glory of the scriptures to accrue to Greece. In Russia, in the time period that I study, Russians referred to their religion, Orthodox Christianity, as the Greek faith. They thought it came from Greece, with maybe some modifications, but that was their basic understanding of its identity. So theologians and people like that want glory to accrue to the Greek language by claiming the New Testament as Greek. But the grammarians, the people who study the language itself and the grammar, say that it's not Greek at all. It has to, you have to maintain the purity of the Greek language apart from this, you know, hybridization that the Jews introduced. So that's a very good illustration of just how someone, even today in Greece, would perceive the text. And I think it's even more evident if you look at it in its historical context. Now, as mentioned, maybe before, maybe after that reference to Argyrios, there is some debate about this concept of Jewish Greek. Now, as you might surmise from what I put on the board, the debate is not within scholarly circles of Judaic studies or Jewish studies or Jewish history. It's perfectly accepted in those academic circles. The debate is within Christian circles. And you can imagine why there might be that debate within Christian circles. Because this is a principle that has an enormous effect on how you understand the Bible. And obviously, again, if we take the analogy of the system, there are certain people within the system, everyone, who have a vested interest in maintaining that system, in not breaking it down and changing the system. Just as in the days of Copernicus, there were people with a vested interest in not abandoning the system of Aristotle and Ptolemy, to the point that Copernicus was not willing to publish his arguments for the heliocentric theory until he was dying, and to the point that Galileo, one of the greatest scientists ever, 70 years later, was put on trial and put under arrest for saying that people should consider the Copernican theory. So in the same way, in the system of Christianity, there are people with a vested interest in not examining what it actually is built on and what it actually contains. Fortunately, we have the opportunity to examine some of those presuppositions, but I say that to explain some of the controversy that's described in the book. In the end, I think there really isn't any controversy, because you saw what the two sides of the debate were. Some people say that there's Jewish Greek. Other people say there's Greek with Jewish influence. Well, it's sort of like what teenagers say, same difference, yeah. You know?
Half full, half empty.
Exactly, yeah. Half full or half empty. So the way that people phrase it means a lot, because you can say that it's Greek, or you can say that it's Jewish. That's the difference. But even the people that are most adamantly opposed to the idea of Jewish Greek recognize that there's something going on. There's Semitic interference with the text. Of course, that shows the presupposition that this is supposed to be some sort of Greek Christian text when there were no Greek Christians. These were Jews who wrote these texts. So there's no Semitic interference. Whatever they were trying to express was Jewish. Peter actually sent out an article from the Jerusalem Post today in which Shmuley Boteach, who's a famous public rabbi, I guess you could say, public figure, makes the statement that the religion that Jesus was promoting, of course, was not Christianity, but Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I think he understands Jesus better than a lot of Christians. And that's kind of the attitude. I'm not saying he's perfect in his understanding of everything, because I don't think he is, but that's sort of the understanding we want to try to attain with regard to the language of the text and therefore how we should understand and interpret it. Okay, I've said a lot. I'll let other people make comments, questions.
Back here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it seems like it's one thing to say that you have the influence of the language, but it's one thing to say that people can understand that there's at least Jewish influence, Hebrew influence on the text. But I think it becomes the more important issue I see is that it becomes, how does that influence how you actually interpret the text? Because then you can say, you know, okay, there's Jewish influence on this. We know that this is from, you know, based on the Tanakh, but what does that mean? You know, there seems like you could just as easily say in people have to. Okay, it doesn't add up to much.
Yeah, so what? What difference does it make? Yeah, that's a good question. Anyone else?
In response, or is it...
Either way. We'll consider that. I'm not going to just ignore your question. But, I mean, it's a good question, so we will discuss it. Yeah, but I just want to let other people make comments, too. Yeah.
I guess it makes a huge difference just because seeing it from a Jewish or a Hebraic perspective, the focus is different. It changes the epicenter of the theology. And so if we're saying, oh, it's just a little Jewish influence, it's more interference, if we understate the Jewishness of the scriptures, then we create a document that isn't really there because it's not going by what the text really says. We're altering it to suit our preconceptions by moving the epicenter to a more Gentile, a more whatever culture standpoint that we're coming from.
Okay. Yep.
No, sorry. Well, so I keep thinking along the same lines, so what? Like, alright, so we determined that it's the whole Bible is written in a Jewish context. So are we saying that what's the end?
Bottom line?
Yes. Bottom line. is it what God is doing through the Jewish people? Future tense or
concept.
What he's done past tense through the Jewish people, and so what? What's the bottom line?
Okay. Yep.
I think the last two or three pages of the chapter kind of start to answer that. Maybe lead to the problem. At first, I was thinking, you know, yes, it's not. I agree with the underlying thoughts in the chapter, but I didn't think it made that much of a difference. But when you start to realize that they've kind of taken the Jew out of. The Jew out of Jesus kind of thing, and they kind of made it their own context and taken the Jewish context out of it, and actually tried to say that they are the new Jews and they've replaced it. I can see where it's a major problem, and it may have been throughout history. I was commenting to Hippus, though, that, you know, since I've become a believer, I have not notice that people that really understand the Bible and read the Bible have not noticed where they realize that Jesus was a Jew and is a Jew, and they are blessed through the Jewish people, and I haven't seen a problem. But it is correctly points out that for many hundreds and thousands of years that was not the case, so I understand it. But I think that's what this whole thing is.
I think just in response to the three of you and Jackie, I think one of the ways the answer to so what is that we've got these Jewish people that are kind of displaced and they're kind of in a peripheral thing, but they kind of annoy you too, and then they come and, you know, all of a sudden we who thought we were so rooted are uprooted. Now we're the displaced people, and then now you've got these insignificant kind of this way and that way people. They're the main people, not us anymore.
As in Romans 11. For example, with the olive tree.
We're not the tree like we thought we were.
Uh-huh. I mean, people, I think most Christians don't have any understanding of what Romans 11 is about. But what it's saying is to Gentiles, don't think that you can exist without the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Now, they took the opposite of Paul's advice, if we can, you know, look at history and see what happened with Roman Christianity. He was writing to Christians in Rome, Gentile Christians in Rome. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you're the unnatural branches. They're the natural branches. Mm-hmm. Jews belong in God's olive tree. Mm-hmm. Whether they've been cut off or whether they haven't been, if they've been cut off, they're natural branches that can be grafted back in. You're unnatural branches that no one would ever think of grafting in to a cultivated olive tree. Because if you take a wild branch of any type of fruit and put it on a cultivated tree, what you're doing is taking the sap of that cultivated tree for no reason to produce bad fruit. Grafting works the other way in nature, in horticulture. If you want to get good fruit, you take a good branch from a cultivated tree and graft it onto an uncultivated tree so that you can use the sap from the bad tree but produce good fruit. Hmm. So Paul's saying no one would ever think of doing what God has done, which is to take Gentiles and graft them on to this tree that he has, because he's cultivated the Jews for millennia. He's given them his word. He's called them his people. To them belong the scriptures and the service of God and the temple and the priesthood and everything that you read about in the Bible. It all belongs to Jews, and from them is Messiah. And as Messiah himself said, salvation is of the Jews. Yeshua is of the Jews. So all these things belong naturally to the Jewish people. And the Gentiles, meanwhile, were uncultivated, as it's described in another verse, without hope, distant from God, separated from God. So in nature, no one would ever take those uncultivated branches and bring them in. They're, as Jessica was saying, they're the unrooted ones, and the Jews are the rooted ones. And yes, that's the exact opposite of how Christianity has viewed things. Mm-hmm. And Christianity has viewed things not only in the opposite manner, but it has taken up the sword in order to enforce that view against the Jewish people. And I think that is part of what's being discussed here. I think that is a very important consequence. I think there's even more than that, though. But go ahead. Yep.
I guess the continuation of what your dad says later in the book, I remember seeing, is that if you recognize that this isn't Greek, this is a hybrid language, this is Hebraic ideas expressed through a different language, then you realize that more and more of the scripture is Jewish Hebrew ideas. And then from there, if so much of the scripture is from Jewish Hebrew ideas, how come so little of the church's teachings involve Jewish Hebrew ideas? It shows a disconnect that something's wrong.
Right. The majority of people who actually believe these texts that talk about Jesus, or Yeshua in Hebrew, the majority of people who believe them are Gentiles. And they have a belief that is not really in any way Jewish, oftentimes. How did that happen? And is that an issue? Is that a problem? Okay, Carmen wanted to say something else.
Yeah, I just thought of something that would show the answer to so what, how does this make a difference? And that is, the article I read earlier, this week or last week, it was an Ann Coulter interview, who's this, very concerned with political commentators. But regardless of her politics, she's basically making the argument in this interview. I think she was talking to a Jewish guy, and she was saying, you should accept Jesus as Messiah because, she actually made the statement, we, as Christians, as Gentile perfected Christians, Jews. We're perfected Jews. Now, I take the most, generous interpretation of what she was saying. I would assume she meant something along the lines of,
you know, Jews who believe in Yeshua as the Messiah are completing their faith. But the way it came out was, I could see how it being incredibly seen as insulting, because basically she's saying, it's inverting Romans 11. It's blurring the
distinction.
So, I mean, I feel like writing her a letter to
I saw that on the Big Idea with Donnie Deutsch. On the Big Idea, I'm obsessed with this show. It's on 10 o'clock if you haven't seen it. It was the most crazy, racist, bizarre thing I'd ever seen someone look someone in the eye. And the way she said it was like, I'm a queen of England, and he's Jewish, obviously. And she just looked at him like, you're a dog. It's like, we Christian. I mean, it was so insulting. Aww. And it's seen by millions of viewers. And he's a very, like, feisty guy. When she said that, he was like, and you can see him look off camera at the set, which he only does it when he makes an incredible joke. He looked off camera, and then she just kept on talking like she was, like, the greatest thing, you know, she's representing Christianity. And then he pulled his glasses down, and right when they were going off the air, right when it was going to break, he said, I am absolutely insulted. You don't talk. And it was going. And it was incredible. I was absolutely disgusted. I could not believe it. It was the most condescending thing I've seen on the air in years.
Your comment on this, it seems the logical conclusion of all this is that the English version of the New Testament, since it's translated from the Greek, is erroneous to a quite undefinable level.
I think that's a good summary. It's erroneous to a quite undefinable level. We're not sure how erroneous it is, but it is erroneous to an undefinable level. And isn't that what this is all about, introducing a little more uncertainty into life?
No, I didn't think it was.
But notice in the comments in the TV show that were being described, not only could they be seen as offensive, obviously, but they're simply not true. Christians are not perfect Jews. In fact, most Christians are not Jewish at all and have no idea what it means to be Jewish in any way whatsoever, mm-hmm. let alone being perfect Jews, more Jewish than someone who's Jewish.
There's enough Jewish people struggling with that identity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Charlie.
I want to build on what Saul just said, but I want you to answer it. And, you know, we're all reading many versions of different translations. And if it's so erroneous, then what is the best messianic writings written? My feeling is David Stern's, because that's as close as we know to Hebraic messianic writings. So what's your feeling on that?
Well, I don't think I'm going to come out in favor of a particular translation. I will mention that one of the reasons why Volume 2 hasn't come out is because that's a project that my father is working on. He's attempting to create a translation that's more in accordance with an understanding of Jewish Greek. I like David Stern's translation, and I read it along with many other translations, and I try to read some in the original as well. David Stern's translation, in my understanding of it, introduces Jewish elements, Jewish cultural elements, into the scripture, but they're not always necessarily the same historical elements of the time period. In other words, it's not necessarily translating from Jewish Greek. It's taking the general understanding of the scriptures and tweaking it a bit to make it sound more Jewish, which may be a good thing, but it doesn't fully rectify the problem. And I'll give you one example of how that might be the case. If I remember correctly, he uses, for example, Yiddish words in translating. Well, Yiddish arose many hundreds of years later. So what he's doing is he's creating a culturally Jewish version of the scriptures, which again may be a good thing, but it's not a translation directly from Jewish Greek.
Gotcha.
I don't think there is one actually in English directly from Jewish Greek. There is one in French, though, by the way, which you might want to take a look at.
What's it called?
André Chouraqui. Translated.
Why the French?
Best perfume, best food.
I'll tell you why the French. I'll tell you why the French. Because Chouraqui is a North African Jew who grew up in this world of Judeo-Arabic and Judeo-Berber and French and everything. So he understands what's going on. He translated Tanakh. He translated the Apocrypha. He translated the scriptures about Yeshua, and he translated the Quran. And wow. Very, very, very idiosyncratic translations into French, but fascinating.
I don't think it's a translation problem. I think it's an interpretation problem. I think it's the people that are teaching the Bible, that are preaching the Bible, that are... It's that connection between the Bible and the teaching and the average Christian.
That's a very good point.
There's a lot of interpretation that goes into translating. You have to do a good bit of interpretation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But there's also, I think the reason the Christian ideas are propagated is because there are sufficient teachers and preachers that will propagate Christian concepts.
Well,
translation problems.
If I can use the analogy again, it's part of the whole system.
Yes.
As we'll read in later chapters, I guess it wasn't explained so much in this particular chapter, but translation supports interpretation and interpretation supports translation. It's a cycle. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to make a translation without interpreting what the original text says, as you mentioned. So it can be very difficult sometimes, and people have to make choices, and they make choices according to whatever conceptions they have in their mind about the original language and what it should mean and how it should be rendered in the other language. I'll just make one comment about the significance of translation, maybe two, as opposed to interpretation after translation. One thing that I noticed, that I have noticed in other countries in discussing scriptural issues with people, is that certain arguments that arise about the Bible in English cannot be expressed in those other languages because the translations are different. Mm-hmm. You could never argue about the same things because no one would understand what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. Issues that arise in other languages that people argue about couldn't be expressed in English because we don't have those same translations. Mm-hmm. So translation in itself is very important in setting the context for what can even be discussed or interpreted. The second thing that I was going to mention previously is that this chapter on Jewish Greek does not begin to talk about all the effects of Jewish Greek. It's just an attempt to introduce you to the idea that this language exists and that it's important. Some of the subsequent chapters will deal with some of the effects, some of the translation errors, or some of the things that might be different if we understand that Jewish Greek exists. So we haven't gotten to that point yet. But I definitely agree that it's a dual process, and interpretation has a lot to do with it, and part of the reason that these bad translations arose in the first place is because of the interpretation that grew up in Gentile Christianity and dictated the way things should be translated.
When I was in Israel, there was a person called David Biven. I don't know if you've heard the name before. He was teaching Hebrew on the suburb of Jerusalem towards Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called Understanding the Difficult Words of Jesus. And that's a fantastic book. You open it up and you read the things, and he points out things that are really hard to understand in the New Testament. I can't bring an example right now, but I have the book at home. I could probably bring it next week. They're just baffling verses when you read them in English, and if you try to read them in Greek, you know, but if you go to the original Hebrew and you think about it in its context and the way they thought back then, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, thank you. And we're going to try to do that with at least one verse today, which is Matthew 1:1.
Okay.
But it could be done with every verse, and I think you're absolutely right. And that's why I said that this understanding has the potential to change your life, in certain cases at least, and why I think it did change my life to a certain extent, or my understanding. Because when you see it in that context, when you see it in the Hebraic context, it has a different meaning often, and it's much clearer. Even if you can't necessarily express exactly what the difference is in English sometimes, you gain a better understanding.
Yeah.
Hopefully
a quick question. I was wondering if there was any prophecy about Babel. If there's any plan, regarding the reason for the split, and is there a thought about reculminating people?
About the reason for what split? Sorry.
Yeah, and this is obviously already starting to get.
Oh, the Tower of Babel.
Yes.
You mean?
Yes.
Okay. Is there a prophecy about it and the reason for it?
Like the millennium about a resolution from it.
Like Millennium Kingdom. Like
I don't... Yeah.
Like we will all speak the same language again.
No. Well, according to the rabbis, in heaven we will all speak Hebrew. So it's a good start would be to learn Jewish Greek. But, but no, according to Revelation, there's, if you remember, there's a great crowd of people from all tongues and tribes and nations and cultures.
Yeah.
So. I'm pretty new to learning, and my memory isn't as good as it
is. No, no.
It's a, class fund everything
it's a pretty specific... Pretty specific question, but yeah, very interesting. Anyone else with questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah. You said your father was working on a translation. What is he starting with? Is he like working from like King James Version or something else, or is he actually starting with word by word every single one?
No, he did compare many of the English versions, and I think originally there was a sort of base English literal version that's available in the public domain that he used to get started. I don't know what it's called, and I'm not even 100% certain that it's accurate that he did that. But then he revised it so much, you know, with a verse-by-verse consideration that it's not really based on any particular translation. Yeah.
Is the Tyndale translation still available?
It is. It's been recently republished, I believe, by Yale University Press. It's you can buy it for $10 or $15. Nice blue cover. Mm-hmm. And you can see very clearly in that the influence of Jewish Greek. Because you'll see, for example, not the name Isaiah, but the name Isaias, which is a direct transliteration from the Greek, which was itself a transliteration from Hebrew, Yeshayahu. And the same with a lot of other names, Jeremias and so forth.
What does he call the Book of James?
I think he calls it Jacob.
Good.
I don't can't say for certain, but I think so.
I think it's Jacob, I-A-C-O-B, Jacob.
Right. Yeah, or Jacobus, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that. Because, of course, that's the actual name, Jacob.
Yeah, of course. All the
Jacob.
Even Spanish, Santiago, Santiago.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, good point. The names are a very interesting example of this whole process. Because Fred brought it up, we'll say a couple words about it. Not too much, because I think it comes up later on. But why, for example, in English New Testaments, do you have the names Mary and James and Jesus, for example? They're not just anglicized. Like, the names, you have anglicized names, but some of them have been actually modified for a specific reason.
Is James named after King James?
Apparently not. Apparently it arose before him, but that's the urban legend. It's not really clear why James replaced Jacob.
It wasn't much of an urban back then, was
it? There were some cities. But in any guesses at the original in Greek for the name Mary, whenever it says Mary, for example, Mary the mother of Jesus?
Miriam.
You know what it says in Greek? Miriam.
That's Greek.
Yeah, that's in Greek because it's transliterated directly from her Hebrew name, which is Miriam. So in Tanakh, if you open up a Christian translation, it will say Maria for the sister of Moses. Mm-hmm. So why does it say Mary for the mother of Jesus? Through this process of translation and interpretation in anti-Judaic theology, there was a specific attempt, a systematic attempt made, which was manifest in various ways, to de-Judaize the faith. Mm-hmm. And here's one way of doing it.
Well, that kind of
her name isn't Miriam. Right, the reason for James is to de-Judaize as well, but why James? How they picked James, we don't really know. Easy to say, maybe. Yeah.
Well, they have in Spain, they had Jaim, you know, is a common Jewish name. And that's where they get the word Jaime. And if you translate Jaime into English, it's James.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it may have a connection with Jaime or Jaim.
It's possible. Very possible. It sounds good. Yeah. Right. A good English name. If King James English was good enough for St. Paul, it's good enough for me, right? But that is kind of the question we're considering. Now, I'm very glad that some people asked, so what? Because I had that in my notes, you know, so what? What difference does it make? And again, We'll get to some of that later on. This is laying the foundations. The subsequent chapters deal with some of the issues that then arise when you compare Jewish Greek to the translations that we currently have. But I think in the remaining time we should at least look at one verse, which is looked at in the chapter. And it's a very appropriate verse to look at. Anyone remember which verse was used?
Matthew 1:1.
And I think it's given to you in the Greek. I might get it a little wrong. We'll see. If I do, someone please correct me. But it says Biblos Geneseos. Must be Iesu Christu Huiu, right, which would be boy, it's been a long time since I've done Greek.
Huiou.
Yeah, it's not actually an H, but okay, we can put that.
It is in the book.
Yeah, okay. It's not
Huiou.
Wait, it has to be like this, right?
Yeah.
Huiou.
Dawid.
Dawid. Huiou.
Abraham.
Does it have an H there?
No.
It wouldn't have an H.
Two A's.
Okay, yeah. There's no H in Greek, so that's why a lot of things fall out. Now, let's not do what everyone does when they read this verse, which is to put it into the standard Christian terminology and Christian understanding of the verse. That's not what's being said at all. In fact, what Christians might understand by this verse. What's being said is something very, very interesting. And this is, you can tell this if you look at that story of the Hasidic man in the chapter. When someone showed him this verse in Hebrew, it was earth-shattering. And, you know, my dad used to travel around a lot, giving sermons in different places and so forth. And one thing that he would say is that God apparently did not know how to write a bestseller. Because who begins a bestseller with a genealogy? He didn't know what would interest people and what would intrigue them. But actually, that idea is based on a wrong understanding of what's being said. To any Jew of the ancient world, or even of the contemporary world today, to read this statement and actually understand it is absolutely earth-shattering.
This is Jewish Greek.
Yeah. But again, how can you tell the difference? They're both written in Greek letters. You have to know the context and you have to understand who wrote it and when and why. So there's no sign saying this is Jewish Greek. It's just written in Greek letters. Just like there's no sign when you look at Yiddish saying this is Yiddish, not Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Now, if you know how to read the Hebrew letters, you can immediately tell that there's a difference. But they're the same letters. Mostly. It's just an example.
These are English letters, though.
These are English letters, yes.
You're not Greek scholars looking at Greek words, okay?
So what is actually being said here? I don't know if you followed the references in the chapter or not. There were references to Genesis 2 and Genesis 5, maybe, and so forth, where this phrase appears in Tanakh. The phrase appears in various forms, not always exactly like this, but throughout Genesis in particular, but then later on. It's what's called in Hebrew Sefer Toldot. I'll write that up.
Sefer book.
That's how we get our root Yelid, is Toldot.
It's right.
Same root Yelid.
Yeah, while I'm writing, why don't you explain it?
Yeah.
Fred.
Well, what more is there to explain?
Well,
so you're writing
Sefer Toldot. I'm writing it in Hebrew first, for those of you who can read Hebrew script, and then I'm writing it in English, Sefer Toldot.
The Book of the Birthings.
The Book of the Birthings, Book of Origins, Book of Generations.
Yeah.
So in Genesis 2, I believe it is, it says, this is the Sefer Toldot Hashamayim V'Haaretz, the book of the generations of the heavens and the earth, the book of the coming into being of the heavens and the earth.
It's showing his royalty.
It could be, but it's talking about the coming into being, and later it says, it talks about the generations of Adam. And it talks later about the generations of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Esau and so forth. So it's an account of the life, it's an account of the coming into existence. And so this is a concept that is directly linked to the very beginning of Tanakh. And again, the point that's being made is that anyone who was in this world, this conceptual world, as soon as they read just these first two words, they would know what was being meant. They would know it was referring to a kind of divine genealogy, if you will, a divine account of coming into being that is from the Torah.
Yeah, it's like you're looking at the staff of generations and you're reading down and seeing that, you know, how he's linked directly to the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And ultimately it comes to God. In the genealogy as well, it comes explicitly to God, I think. So it's saying, here's going to be an account that is at least as significant as some of the other accounts. You know, the Sfarei Toldot of, let's say, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Adam. These are very important people in Jewish history. Mm-hmm. So if someone else is getting a Sefer Toldot, this is something pretty substantial, something pretty important. Who is this person who has a new Sefer Toldot? Or who is this, what is the entity? Because the Shemaim and the Aretz, the heavens and the earth, also have their Sefer Toldot. So in Hebrew, what it says is Yeshua, a common Jewish name, usually translated as Joshua, translated in Christian New Testament translations as Jesus instead. But Yeshua, Christu, we know what this means now.
The anointed.
The anointed one. Yeshua, Mashiach. So he's anointed of God in some way. So some Jew with the name of Yeshua is anointed of God, and he's a son of David and a son of Abraham. What does that bring to mind? You have the entire message right here. It's saying this is the Messiah promised to Israel from the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. That's what this book is about.
The son of David is, he's the son of the kingly line, and the son of Abraham, he's a line of, he's the father of all of our faith, you know. I mean,
right.
It's a big thing.
Yeah, the kingly line and the line of true faith in God. And, by the way, just a side note, it almost seems petty at this point to bring this in, but to demonstrate Jewish Greek, in a regular Greek text, they would never use this form of son of David, son of Abraham. That's the Jewish way of saying something. Ben David, Ben Avraham, you know, Ben Yosef, whatever. In Greek, you would have a suffix to indicate that someone was a son of the father. So here's another peculiarity of Jewish Greek, that it repeats the Hebraic form, son of, son of, son of, all the time and all throughout the chapter. There, it repeats then the form in Tanakh of the genealogy. So this is a statement that would cause anyone, especially in the context of Roman reign when Jews were looking for a deliverer, to sit up and pay attention, and to, whether they were religious or not, whether they thought God was going to deliver them or not, whether they believed a Messiah was going to come or not, they would understand what was meant. They would understand the claim that was already made in this first verse. And I think it's not an exaggeration to say that most Christians today and most Christian translations today of this verse do not convey that same sense. Would you agree with me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, what does it say in English?
Well, let's leave aside the English. I mean, we can translate it ourselves if we want, but we'll see that even our best English translation will fall short. You know, the book of the genealogy of Yeshua the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
Yeah.
But it's still, even that doesn't fully convey it.
Well, because we don't have the same, I hate to say this, but almost like the same awe for Genesis. You know what I'm
right.
saying? Because, yeah, I mean, we know that's the book, where, you know, God created everything, yeah, yeah. But mm-hmm. for a Jewish person, it's like, this is what they've been waiting for, and you hand this to them, that's why that guy had such a reaction.
Right, and Genesis is the account of the creation of the world. Mm-hmm. For a Jewish person in that day, you know, it wasn't a day of debate so much with evolution, although mm-hmm. there might have been other atheistic theories or polytheistic theories and so forth, but it was God's explanation of how the world came into existence. And so it was very serious, and it was something that set the Jewish people apart from every other people on earth. So the link, as you're saying, would be felt very strongly.
The New King James substitutes genealogy for Genesis.
Well, no, it's that's a correct translation. It's mm-hmm. it's genial. It's it's half a correct translation. It depends what you think is the best way of doing a translation, but probably a better translation is Book of the Generations, which is essentially a genealogy. But genealogy does not convey what is meant with the link back to Genesis and so forth.
Genealogy sounds pretty boring being an American.
It does. Yeah.
It does. But when I hear it in Hebrew, it makes me sit up. It does.
Mm-hmm. Well, here I was reading your father saying the origin mm-hmm. of what he was thinking mm-hmm. of. So I guess I was thinking of that as Genesis in my mind. Is sort of
right. Bad. If you look at the places in, it's not Bereshit. It's a different word from Bereshit. Bereshit means like at the first. And if you look at Shir HaKi's translation, you'll see that he translates it as en tête, like in the head, which is a very literal meaning. But toldot means sort of like generations or periods of coming into existence. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to translate. Most translations in English, when they say the toldot Hashemayim v'haaretz, the generation, the toldot of the heavens and the earth, they say origins or something like that. So there are different translations for this word, but however you translate it, you can understand either in Hebrew or in Jewish Greek what it's talking about.
Mm-hmm. If you're lucky.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little unlucky.
And someone who read this verse would then want to read the genealogy. They would want to know who this person was and where he came from. And if he could possibly be the Messiah.
It's fascinating. It's the word is like childings, you know. Like mm-hmm. you bring, it's part of humanity. I mean, it's
right.
It's a mind blower when you think about it, when you meditate on it.
Yeah, I think so. And that's one of the fascinating things about Jewish Greek. Now, it of course, different people can get into it to different extents, depending upon you know linguistic exposure and so forth. But you can pore over each word and just feel this fascination with it, which you do not feel in English. And you, so there's that side to it, but there's also the side of being much more accurate. Now, what I wanted to say, based on the commentary on this verse, if you've understood how I presented it, you'll see that it's not at all a question of taking English translations and sort of arguing that, well, yes, they should be Jewish, we need to make them more Jewish. When you understand this in its historical context, it's nothing but Jewish. There's no room for an iota of anything else. It's fully Jewish. There's no room for a Greek iota of anything. Iota is a Greek letter. And there really isn't. Like, if you've understood what's being said,
do your job. Good.
It's not at all Greek. It's not at all Christian. It's fully... It's just the epitome of a Jewish expression of the hope in Messiah and a statement that God has sent him. And if you can imagine removing all of the rest of everything that came in the last 2,000 years and just starting from that point and looking at it from the original, you can imagine just by comparing this first verse that we're going to get a lot of richness and a lot of meaning that it does not exist in our English translations today and cannot exist in the Christian system, so to speak, in the system per se of Christianity. So I think that's one of the illustrations that best explains what Jewish Greek is, especially when you're just starting to get into it. Any other questions? We have 4 minutes left. Yeah.
Something good, but so what? I was thinking growing up, you know, it really emphasizes the fact, and I have known that this is one book. And you know, a lot of Christians, they talk about the Jewish Bible and mm-hmm. the Christian Bible.
Right.
And, you know, you see this, it really just emphasizes the fact that it is one book. Because, you know, I just was talking about a while ago, they were talking about that in this whole book, but they asked this, somebody asked somebody, what percentage of the scriptures talk about the Jewish people?
Mm-hmm.
And... So you? I don't know.
Yeah, it was in last class. Yeah,
70
yeah.
people. It was. And if 70 people were,
or
you know,
90,
most churches
don't
preach from the Tanakh. And I'm saying if they would see this and see, you know, well, okay, if this is in you know Jewish Mm-hmm. And this is Jewish, and we value this, then we should value this equally.
Right.
And I think that's what we're talking about, changing your mind and everything, you know.
I think so, yes. And I think it, for many Christians, it's a gradual process. Mm-hmm. But I think also if you just remove the whole world of Christianity and just think of trying to understand the Bible, it shows the extent to which Christianity is off-center. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the right center. It doesn't understand the full message of what God is saying. And in that respect, it is like the geocentric system, which seemed to explain the solar system if you made it complicated enough, if you explained away a lot of natural realities, but didn't really, was not a very good explanation at all. And there was a much simpler explanation there all the time, even from ancient Greek times, which was true and made sense if only people would be willing to consider it. And they weren't willing to consider it for a long time. But eventually, they were, and that changed the world. So again, to go back to the end of chapter 1, how much more will this change the world if we have an accurate understanding of God's word? Just a couple of comments in closing. I think that the true question is, so what, in a sense? You know, so what? What difference does it make? And I think we're starting to see some of the answer to that. But I'd like to suggest a couple points to think about for next time. First of all, is simply the most basic of all Hebrew conceptions, the conception most identified with God, and that is truth. Are we interested in truth? Are we interested in emet? Every time we say amen, we're saying, may it be true, may it be so. Mm-hmm. It's an association with the character of God, what is true, what is right. Are we interested in what's true? Mm-hmm. That's the so what. That's the first thing. The second thing I want to suggest is that if it's true that God has chosen the Jewish people as his possession, as his special possession, and that he cares about them in the way that he has described throughout the Bible, then he has a very deep love for his people, and he wants to be in relationship with them. And if you hand a normal Jewish person a New Testament or attempt to convert them to Christianity, they will have a very bad reaction. And rightly so. And now you can see, if we look at this, why it's a right reaction, or some of why it's a right reaction. Because the message that has been presented in Christianity is not the message that God presented in the writings about Yeshua. And so if we're at all interested in sharing in God's heart for his people, in his plan for the redemption of the whole world, which involves the salvation of the Jewish people, then we should be interested in returning to the message which the Messiah brought when he said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So just a couple light matters to think about for next time.
Okay. Thank you.